So that's where reflexive ethnography comes into play to say when we write usually our methodology sections, we sanitize them. We never talk about what actually transpired and what are the things that were said to us by the research participants. We simply focus on the answers to our specific questions. But reflexive ethnography gives us the opportunity to actually say, who was I when I was doing the research? And when you ask this question, you notice that in most cases, especially in social research using qualitative methods, you are not just a researcher. And sometimes they don't even think you are a researcher. Of course, they know you have told them I'm a researcher, but they don't really pay so much attention to that. They will decide how they want to identify you, and that will shape how they react to your presence and even answer your questions or refuse to answer your questions for that matter.
Willkommen zum Podcast Melting Pot Migration im Dialog. In diesem Podcast sprechen wir mit NachwuchswissenschaftlerInnen aus verschiedensten Fachgebieten, die zum Thema Migration forschen. Ein Einblick also in die Migrationsforschung über die Grenzen wissenschaftlicher Disziplinen hinweg. Organisiert wird der Podcast vom Nachwuchsnetzwerk des Interdisziplinären Zentrums für Integrations- und Migrationsforschung an der Universität Duisburg-Essen.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen. Hello and welcome to a new episode of Melting Pot, Migration im Dialog. Today you've guessed it already and I mixed it up already in English. And today we're going to talk about a topic that we've talked about before on this podcast, gender and migration. But there are differences in how one might understand gender and sex, and these differences can be based on individual perspectives, but also on cultural ones. And today we are talking about such differences as how gender is viewed in different cultures, as well as cultural aspects of mobility. But as culture not only plays a role in the way we understand terms such as gender and migration mobility, it can also influence the research process itself. So today we are also looking at intercultural and intercultural issues while conducting research. And we are going to learn more about this today from our guest, Dr. Rose Jarji from the German Institute of Development and Sustainability, who will be sharing with us insights into her work on gender and migration, as well as on reflexive ethnography. Hello and welcome, Rose.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
And as yet another first today, it is my pleasure to introduce my co-host for today, Dennis. Hello, Dennis.
Hey there.
All right. Rose, thanks again for being here. Of course, we've looked at your CV before we invited you to this podcast, and your CV has brought you to various universities where you have taught in the past, in Zimbabwe, for example, but also in Duisburg, where we are, or also in Munich. And while some people might associate Munich with the Oktoberfest, North Rhine-Westphalia is maybe more known for its carnival season. Do you have a preference between these two festivals, or yeah, some might even call them holidays, or have you even visited either?
I've visited the Oktoberfest before, and I prefer the Oktoberfest to Carnival. I'm sorry.
Well, it's fine.
And yeah, the second either or question we want to ask you now is steering into a more research related topic. What is your preferred methodology of research? Is it more a quantitative view or a qualitative view? Which would you choose?
I prefer qualitative. It speaks better to me in terms of explaining things.
Okay, great. Yeah. So this episode centers around migration and gender, which are also like prominent themes in your research. Starting off, when we checked your research, we saw that you did some great ethnographic work in Zimbabwe, and something that was very striking to me is the different cultural perceptions on gender. As I read it, gender is not a rigid category there, as it can be in Germany, and it's more understood to be situational in situational context. Could you please elaborate on that?
Yes, sure. Thank you so much, Dennis, for this question. I would start by saying that, you know, this is not unique to Zimbabwean cultures. You find it in a lot of African cultures, for that matter, where there's a lot of fluidity or flexibility when it comes to gender. And then when we say gender situational, we're basically also looking at the role of kinship structure in these cultures, where you notice that your maternal uncle, who is biologically male, can become your social mother because he is your mother's brother. And similarly, your paternal aunt, who is your father's sister, can become your female father, so to speak. So in a context like this, you also find that the language itself is adapted to this kinship structure, where, for example, our third person pronoun is gender neutral. So when you listen to the pronoun, the third person pronoun in, for example, my language, you cannot tell whether the person is male or female because we use the same pronoun for everyone. So when you have this kind of culture, what you notice is that it has some internal logic, which enables it to shift whenever necessary. So you can be biologically male or female, but socially the opposite, right, in terms of gender. So sex and gender are not aligned in this culture. It's possible to be one sex and actually live the opposite gender. And situational basically facilitates this fluidity where you can do your back and forth as the situation demands. So if you are called in to be the paternal aunt, you are going to be female. And then if you are being called in to be the female father, you are going to be the father socially, but you don't have to change your biology for you to be able to play the role of a female father.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I found that very striking. And now turning probably to a migration angle on that, as you said, those socially situated perceptions are also bound to like privileges and obligations. They're connected to that, as Zimbabwe is, has experienced an economic crisis. A lot of workers, and especially skilled workers, choose to migrate, and that is also affecting on a wider level those gender and family dynamics. So could you please tell us what you found in your research about that?
So maybe just a brief overview in terms of how gender and migration have played out in the context of Zimbabwe. So what I just explained in terms of gender and this fluidity is more of the traditional culture, which was disrupted with colonization. Zimbabwe became a settler colony in the 1890s when the British settlers occupied this land and named it Southern Rhodesia at that time. So this came with changes to the culture, where you notice that migration was introduced for purposes of indigenous labor in the mines and on the farms and also in the domestic households of the settlers. So they were coming from this Victorian ideology where gender was binary, understood in binary terms. You are either female or male. And then they come with this mindset to a country where, like I said, you know, gender is situational. And they introduced this new understanding of gender. And the result was that it targeted men for migrant labor. So women were not allowed to move. They were supposed to stay in the villages. And if they had to move, they were required to apply for passes that would allow them to travel without problems with authorities. So you have that kind of change happening during the colonial period where migration was masculinized and the domestic sphere was feminized, which was a bit alien to the people who occupied this land that became known as Zimbabwe. And then you fast forward to resistance to colonial rule. And then you find that the people, the indigenous people in this country, sort of go back to their culture, where both women and men moved in terms of going to neighboring countries to get trained in order to come back and fight for liberation. So in this context, you notice that migration becomes something that both women and men can do as they go out for training in order to come back and fight. And then you move on to the post-independence period, where migration is less about resistance and then liberation, and it's more about searching for economic opportunities. And you find that there is that remnant of masculinization of migration, but at the same time, you begin to see women moving into this sphere where they play economic roles, where they also migrate. Sometimes even initiating the migration ahead of men as husbands, for example. So here, that's where you begin to see changes in terms of who plays what role within the household. Is the role of the breadwinner strictly a male role, or women also play this role? And this change, which happens as a result of women also migrating, has implications on gender relations and also gender roles, especially within families. So families in terms of spouses, and also in terms of parents and their children, or in terms of siblings, in which case, if a female sibling migrates, then she's likely to enjoy more power and experience upward social mobility within the family, because she becomes the person who brings the resources into the family. So if she has brothers who remain in Zimbabwe, now they have to listen to what she says. Let's say she sends remittances. She can send them and specifically state the purpose of these remittances. And she expects the people back in Zimbabwe to actually do exactly what she's saying, because she's the one who has earned this money. So in this context, you can see how things change in terms of gender roles and even in terms of power. And that takes us back to the fluidity that I mentioned at the beginning, that power is not inherent in any gender. It depends on whether you can fulfill certain obligations.
Yeah, that was that's a super interesting aspect. Mm-hmm. In our pre-interview, we already talked about the ambivalences there, that there is an economic empowerment dimension, but there are also, besides the opportunities, there are sometimes threats regarding the informality and also vulnerability. As you mentioned, you mentioned the masculinization of mobility and labor, and also liberation struggles. And so I would also like to move on from a kind of local perspective to a more global or more an external perspective on migration. And in your work, you also challenge ideas about feminization of migration, especially on the African continent. So would you like to explain what that means and why that is something that can be harmful?
I think I'll say two things there. Number one, we seem to assume that the best way for women to show that they are empowered, so to speak, is through migration. Then the moment we do that, we're also assuming that those who do not migrate are suffering, which is not exactly the point. So sometimes I tend to hear people kind of celebrate the numbers of women who are migrating. But what does this really mean for the women who are migrating? Is this making their lives better? So I did mention in my previous answer that women can actually enjoy higher social status as a result of migration. But we also need to be cautious when we talk about this. Migrant women, especially those who are in the low income bracket, also face challenges when they migrate. So here I'm basically cautioning against the tendency to celebrate the numbers and say, oh, women, more women are migrating, so that is a good thing. It's not always the case that when women move, that is to their benefit. If you look at the literature, you find that a lot of women who migrate, especially those who are in low-income jobs, experience a lot of challenges. You know, they're also vulnerable to various problems such as sexual and gender-based violence. If you look at what happened during COVID-19, you can actually see the challenges that migrant women who are in the low-income jobs experienced. So I usually approach these issues on the basis of empirical evidence. What exactly is happening? What are the women saying? So is feminization of migration a good thing? In which context can we look at it as something that is positive? And in which context do we see the challenges that women face as a result of migration? Do they really want to migrate? Right. So if you have situations where women would prefer not to migrate, but they are migrating nonetheless, then a lot of caution is needed in discussing those kinds of cases.
Okay. That was also a very important addition to the ambivalence of mobility. But if we could also take another go at the idea of feminization of migration, especially from an external perspective, if you would just, if you could just explain the term and what that means to you. Yeah.
Yeah, so feminization would basically be the opposite of what I refer to as masculinization of migration. So when you now say feminization, you're basically talking about more numbers of women engaging or participating in any event, in this case, in migration. So feminization, women become more visible in migration. You don't just see one gender, or you don't just see people who are not women. You also see women being actively involved, especially in their own capacity as individual migrants, because in previous decades, if you look at the literature, you would see women appearing as accompanying spouses, or people who would follow their spouses a few months later, or a few years later. But now you have increasing numbers of women who are migrating in their own individual capacity to look for employment in order to take care of families. So that also points to the idea of women becoming breadwinners in their families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what I have taken away so far is that also culture or culture-based perspectives are something that runs through the whole research process, because it defines the way we interpret things. And what I've learned from you is that in publications, it's often left out the relationship between researchers and research participants. And in one article on reflexive ethnography and refugee research, which we are happy to link to, you address these very issues that can arise here in this field. And to understand this maybe more clearly, and perhaps to give our listeners a feel for it, what does reflexive ethnography even mean?
Okay, reflexive ethnography basically means the role that the researcher plays in the research interface. So we mm-hmm. normally assume that if you're doing research, you're going there and you're not going to be part of the context. You're just going to ask questions and get answers, more like a fly on the wall kind of situation, where you ask questions and then you listen. Or if you are coming from anthropology, you just stand somewhere and you observe what is happening. But then in reflexive ethnography, you acknowledge that you're also an agent in this interface, in the field where you're doing research. So whether you notice it or you don't notice it, you're playing a role. Your presence there changes things. People will notice you're there. So it means life is not the same. We have a guest, whichever way they want to identify you. So they may say, we have a guest. And then if you stay longer, maybe they'll say you're a researcher, or whatever the identity they may come up with. And those identities actually influence how the research will be conducted, and even the data coming from the research, because once people decide this is who you are, they relate with you accordingly. So that's where mm-hmm. reflexive ethnography comes into play, to say when we write usually our methodology sections, we sanitize them. We never talk about what actually transpired and what are the things that were said to us by the research participants. We simply focus on the answers to our specific questions. But reflexive ethnography gives us the opportunity to actually say, who was I when I was doing the research? And when you ask this question, you notice that in most cases, especially in social research using qualitative methods, you are not just a researcher, and sometimes they don't even think you are a researcher. Of course, they know you have told them I'm a researcher, but they don't really pay so much attention to that. They will decide how they want to identify you, and that will shape how they react to your presence and even answer your questions, or refuse to answer your questions for that matter.
Mm-hmm. And you also, in your article, you point out this what you just said, but you pointed out naming like intercultural and also intracultural issues during the research process. And you mentioned it a little bit before, but could you please give us maybe two examples for both kinds? Mm-hmm. What would be like an intercultural issue during the research process and what an intracultural issue?
Yes, let me start by saying these two things can also come in a continuum where you're mm-hmm. being an insider exists in a kind of continuum. So, for example, I can be outside an insider when I do research in Zimbabwe. But if I travel to a region where I don't speak the local language, then I become an outsider. Mm-hmm. So you see the fluidity here in terms of at what point am I an insider and then I become an outsider. So in situations where you're an insider, I think you need to be wary as a researcher of the fact that the people, the research participants assume that you know what they're talking about because you are an insider. So it's very possible that you hear people say, you know what it is or you know how it is like here. And then if you are doing research, obviously I've experienced these kinds of situations where people trail off and then they expect me to know what they were going to say because they think I'm an insider. And what I normally do is to just say, I'm not sure about that. Can you clarify what you mean? Right. So I'm basically showing that I'm here to do research and not to just, you know, maybe engage in some kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where I already know the conclusion. I'm just going to do research to validate my conclusion. In these kinds of situations where you're an insider, then you need to also understand that there are things that you don't understand. And I've used before this example of music in my language. So we have a musician, he's now late, called Oliver Mtukudzi, one of the greatest musicians in Zimbabwe. He speaks in my language. I love his music. But when someone who does not speak the language asks me to translate the music, I struggle, and I'm not the only person who struggles, right? Mm-hmm. So we all understand what he's saying, all the words in the songs, the lyrics, we understand them. But when someone says, what does he mean? We know what he means, but we don't know how to translate it into a language which is palatable to the other person. So that's a good example of the intracultural research where you find that you are an insider, but you do not quite understand. I've seen Oliver Mtukudzi explain his music clearly, right? But I fail, and other Zimbabweans, we fail to explain this music much as we understand the language and we understand all the words in the music. So you can see the shortcomings there in terms of assuming that just because you're an insider, it means you understand things better. It's not always the case. And then intercultural research, I think this brings us to the issue of concepts. Do concepts apply to the same situations? If poverty means something here in Germany, for example, can we take that definition of poverty to some country, let's say in Africa, and say whatever we see, if it suits or if it conforms to what we have observed in Germany, then we'll use the same term, we'll call it poverty as well. And I love this example of South Sudan, a group there which has what is known in anthropology as the cattle complex. They keep cattle mostly for their aesthetic value. They love cattle. They don't kill them for meat. So beef is not something that is big there, although people can have maybe 1,000 heads of cattle. Now, you encounter these people and you look at them. If you're going to use Western standards, these are poor people. You know, they're barefoot. They are not wearing anything that's really presentable in terms of, you know, this is expensive and things like that. Till you talk to them and then you see the resistance when you say you want to give them money so that you can buy maybe a head of cattle there, and they say no, the cattle mean much more to them than money, so they don't care about the money. And then you also try to convert the number of cattle they have to cash, which is the value that we understand. And then you see how much money is this. If you convert 1,000 heads of cattle to euros or to US dollars, how much money is this? So maybe you come up with a quarter of a million US dollars or euros. Then is that still poverty? Right. So we need to understand how different people understand wealth or measure wealth in different ways, right? These are people who not spend a dollar or more per day to buy basic necessities such as food. So someone who lives maybe in a Western country will go and buy a liter of milk, and these people will not do so. What will they do? They will milk the cows themselves and come up with 20 liters of milk without spending even a single dollar. So when we say they do not or they live on less than a dollar per day, I do understand what this means. But for these people, does that really mean poverty, right? So they grow their own fruits, organic fruits, which tend to be expensive in some parts of the world. They grow those using the same kettle, the manure coming from the same kettle, so they don't buy fertilizers. And then they have their milk. And should they want to have beef, they can have beef without spending money. And then they have their gardens. So you can have a wholesome meal, which is healthy and nutritious without spending even a single dollar. And then you go to these people and you say you are poor. What exactly are you saying to these people? And do they understand what you mean by telling them you are poor? So those are examples in brief of situations where you can face challenges as a researcher. And sometimes you do research. And these days we have to remember the people that we research with also read what we write. And sometimes they're also scholars. So when you write something without reflecting on the local context and how things are interpreted, then it shouldn't be shocking that people can come out and challenge the results that you present as your research findings. So we need to remember this is very important in terms of when you do research in a different culture or in your own culture, what are the issues that you need to look out for?
Yeah, great examples, and especially the one with how to look on poverty or how to define poverty, that really stuck with me over the weekend. And also the article I mentioned before, it is mostly based on your own research experience with refugees in Nairobi, and in that you state that ethnographic research often like blurs boundaries that are taken for granted, but could you maybe tell us a little bit more about what you've observed, but especially regarding the relationship between researchers and research participants? Because you said before, researchers are not just the flies on the wall who just observe.
Yes. So like I said, when you go to do research, usually you're thinking of yourself as a researcher. This is the identity that matters to you. And then when you get there, that's when you begin to see other issues coming out in terms of maybe people assigning you new identities. So from my experience doing ethnography in Nairobi, Kenya, I went there thinking I was a researcher. And then I arrived in Nairobi and I noticed that for the refugees, this tag did not really matter. The research tag was almost irrelevant. Of course, they knew I was doing research. I told them, I explained everything, you know, research ethics and everything else. But they decided how they wanted to identify me. So I became a foreigner like them because Kenya is not my country and they are also foreigners in Kenya. So I'm thinking, okay, so when the same group were all foreigners in Kenya, and then they tell me, oh no, but wait a minute. You're not a refugee in Kenya. You can go to your embassy and they will listen to you. We cannot go to the embassies of our countries because they represent governments that forced us to flee our homes. So I'm thinking, okay, so this is where the difference is. I'm not a refugee. That's a difference to them. Then they say, oh, yeah, you're African. So you're one of us. I'm thinking, okay, I belong. And then the next thing they're like, oh, you come from Zimbabwe, so you don't come from our country. So it kept shifting so that in the end, you know, I found it amusing. So where exactly am I to these people, right? And then I noticed that I'm an insider and at the same time, I'm also an outsider. So in some situations, I'm one of them. In other situations, I'm different, right? They would say things like, you're in Kenya out of choice. We did not choose to be in Kenya. So that's also a difference. And then this has implications on the research itself. For example, some said they wanted to get paid. And I'm thinking, this is ethnography. I'm going to live in the community. So I'm a student. I can't afford to pay people. And as a person, I've always had concerns about paying research participants because students, African students, also go to the same field to do research, and usually they don't have scholarships. So if we introduce the culture of paying for data, then we're also making it difficult for local students to do research. So usually I refuse to pay. So they said they wanted to get paid, and I said, I'm a student, I can't afford to pay. And then I'm thinking, well, I've lost these participants, potential participants. And then they would sit there and then say, oh, you know what, I think I'll participate in the research. I'm like, no, but I told you I don't have money, so I will not be able to pay. And they say, oh, no, you know, don't worry, you are African, your PhD is our PhD kind of situation, right? So this facilitated my access to data. Of course, they had welcomed me already, but now they're telling me, we didn't want to talk to you when we heard you were a researcher. But now we're thinking, she's also African. So in that sense, she's one of us. When she gets her PhD, it's for all of us. I think, you know, this is something that is also unique to Africa, that we have our respective countries, but there are moments when we also see ourselves as one people, as a people, where we say we're all Africans. So I had to constantly juggle these kinds of things. I couldn't really fix and pin them down and say, okay, this is it, this is who I am. I kept finding myself in these situations where I bore these shifting identities. And I noticed that this kept playing a role in terms of, you know, doing the research. I'm their sister, I'm their daughter. You know, it kept going on and on like that. And at some point I stopped even noticing and thinking I was a researcher. So it was just like, you know, I'm now a neighbor because I've lived there for half a year. So I'm now one of the big people in the compound. And it was quite fascinating to see these kinds of things that by the time you leave, you know, you were doing research, but you are not exactly thinking about yourself as a researcher because people have made clear, or they've made the point of making sure that they relate with you using other identities, which you may have thought these are irrelevant to the research encounter.
So it's like you said before, so it's not for the researchers to decide who they are or how they are viewed by the research participants. So it actually goes both ways, because researchers like to put labels on people, or like identify people or research participants, because you also said when we talked last week that someone told you no one was ever so interested in my identity than researchers, and that quote also really stuck with me. Could you maybe please also from your own experience, from your own research, tell us a little bit more about those identity constructions that are maybe viewed as foreign for the research participants?
So from my experience doing research, I think I shared this anecdote that when I went to Kenya, this was in 2006 to 2007. So at that time, I remember people asking me, why are you even studying refugees? Where is this coming from? So it seems for many people, this was not like, you know, a common topic to research on. So I realized when I got to Kenya, to Nairobi, that so far the people, the refugees living in Nairobi, had mostly encountered people who were not Black people doing research with refugees. So my friend took me to this Roman Catholic parish where the refugees would come for assistance. And then she's talking to the women who are sitting there waiting to be assisted. And he says, I have my friend who is here and she's doing research with refugees. Would you be so kind as to participate in this research? And this woman is dismissive. She simply says, I don't speak to researchers. Just that sentence, and she keeps quiet. So I can hear this. I'm sitting not exactly in a spot where she can see me, but I can hear this is what she said. And then I'm thinking, so how am I going to do this research then? And then she sits there for a few minutes, and then she says, oh, this friend of yours who is doing research, where is she? And then he points at me and says, that's her. And this woman says, but how come you didn't tell me she was African? And he says, but I said she's a researcher. He says, no, but you didn't tell me she was African. I'm listening to this conversation. I'm like, so what exactly is going on here? So eventually I understood that, like I said at the beginning, if you're a researcher and you're African and you're a researcher and you're not African, these people notice these kinds of differences, which I found amazing because I thought, okay, if you are doing research, you are doing research, these things do not matter. I hadn't even thought about them, that, you know, they would look at me and see me as an African. I just felt, okay, they would just look at me and say, oh, she's doing research, that's it. So you have this idea where people will place researchers into categories also based on their previous experiences, because I wanted to know, you know, I was doing research, so I wanted to know why it mattered that my being African was an issue in this research. You know, it would open doors for me. And then I realized that they had had experiences, and when people experience certain things and you go to do research as an individual, sometimes you are converted into a representative of a certain group which is associated with those previous experiences. So researchers from the West, the issue in this particular context, I'm not saying that's what always happens, but at least from what they explained, it was basically that they'd spoken to people who went there from the West, and you know, refugees live in difficult conditions and circumstances. So when you get there and then they tell you, you know, I was a student at the university and I had to drop out and flee and things like that, so I would be happy to get a scholarship and study in a Western country and things like that, to get resettled in a Western country. And then it's important to just tell them, I am unable to provide this kind of assistance. And I don't think this is what happened, at least from the refugees. I'm not sure whether this is true or not, but this is what they said. That they had been promised a lot of things, and then when these people leave, they never look back. They do not write. So maybe they leave behind their email addresses, and the refugees who take the trouble to go and sit in an internet cafe at that time and write to these researchers, oh, how far with this situation, you said you'd help, and they silence. So that's where the resentment came from, in terms of, you know, I don't talk to researchers. Oh, you are African. Okay, we haven't had experiences with African researchers. Let's try and see. And then that's when he think like, oh, I want to do this and that. And then I'm like, I'm a student. I can't pay you, or I don't have the means to help you get resettled in a Western country and things like that. So you begin to see this insider-outsider issue also coming back to even make it difficult for people to do research. And this has implications, ethical implications, on how we gain access to the field as well. What do we say for people to open doors to us so that we can do research?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really important note to end with, and maybe also to take it as a warning. Thank you for these insights and your time today, Rose. Unfortunately, we have already reached the end of this episode, so there's nothing left for us to do but ask you if there's anything else you would like to add, or if there's anything that perhaps has been missed out. So the last words are yours.
Okay, thank you so much. Maybe just a quick note to say that I also want to, I would be happy to see more research focusing on men. Sometimes when you talk about gender, we forget that gender includes men. It includes, you know, all kinds of people. It's not just about women. So this confinement of gender, I think it bothers me. So in my work, I always try to write about men, whether I'm talking about men as migrants or men as refugees and issues relating to masculinity. So I try to balance these things. If I'm talking about femininity, I'm asking myself, so what are the implications for masculinity, and bring everyone in there. So I always want to make sure that research on gender is including everyone, of course, based on the data that one found when they were doing the research. And having said that, I think I'd like to say thank you so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Okay, the pleasure is all on your side, on our side too. Thank you for your time. For my part, really enjoyed the conversation. I also want to thank our listeners. If they choose to, they can follow us on Twitter at at Incentim, and if they feel free, just write some nice comments, please. That would be the end of the episode. Thank you very much, and yeah, goodbye.
Thank you. Bye. Goodbye.
Das war's mit dieser Ausgabe des Podcasts Melting Pot – Migration im Dialog. Für mehr Informationen über die Arbeit unseres Netzwerkes und für Updates zum Podcast findet ihr uns auf Twitter unter @incentim. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis zum nächsten Mal.